Busted appliance? This is your sign to upgrade. Shop at Lowe's to get up to 35% off and next day delivery on hundreds of major appliances. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 3/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Order by 4 p.m. Available Monday through Saturday. Subject to availability. Fees, exclusions, and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/appliance delivery for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The Scottsboro boys were 9 African-American teenagers aged 12 to 19 accused in Alabama of raping 2 white women in 1931. The cases included a lynch mob before the suspects had been indicted. All white juries, rushed trials, and racist cultures all led to one thing: chaos. This is their story today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
This is part 3 of the Scottsboro Boys story on The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Verdict. The jury began deliberating Saturday afternoon and announced it had a verdict at 10 in the next morning. While many residents of Decatur were in church, the jury foreman, Eugene Bailey, handed the handwritten verdict to Judge Horton. The judge found the defendant guilty of rape and sentenced Patterson to death in the electric chair. Bailey had held out for 11 hours for life in prison, but in the end agreed to the death sentence. According to one count, juror Irwin Craig held out against the imposition of the death penalty because he thought that Patterson was innocent. Irwin Red Craig died in 1970, nicknamed for the color of his hair, was the sole juror to refuse to impose a death penalty in the retrial of Haywood Patterson, one of the Scottsboro boys in what was then the small town of Decatur, Alabama. His son, Sonny, later recalled him saying, "Those young men were innocent. Everybody knew that, but they were going to be punished for what they didn't do." The Ku Klux Klan stalked a burning cross in his family yard. He was called in to see the judge presiding over that retrial, James Horton, who exonerated him to change his vote to guilty. "If you don't, they will kill you, Red," said the judge. Craig protested. "I can't change my vote, Judge," Horton replied. "Don't worry about that. I'll take care of it." The defense moved for a retrial, and believing the defendants were innocent, Judge James Edwin Horton agreed to set aside the guilty verdict for Patterson. Horton ruled the rest of the defendants could not get a fair trial at that time and indefinitely postponed the rest of the trials, knowing it would cost him his job when he ran for re-election. Judge Horton heard arguments on the motion for a new trial in the Limestone County Courthouse in Athens, Alabama, where he read his decision to the astonished defense and furious night. "These women are shown to have falsely accused these two men. This tendency on the part of the women shows that they are predisposed to make false accusations. The court will not pursue the evidence any further." Horton ordered a new trial, which would turn out to be the third for Patterson. When Judge Horton announced his decision, Knight stated that he would retry Patterson. He said that he had found Orville Carolina Slim Gilly, the white teenager, in the gondola car and that Gilly would corroborate Prince's story in full. At Knight's request, the court replaced Judge Horton with Judge William Washington Callahan, described as a racist. He later instructed the jury in the next round of trials that no white women would voluntarily have sex with a black man. New trials under Callahan during the Decatur trial, held from November 1933 to July 1937, Judge Callahan wanted to take the case off the front pages of America's newspapers. He banned photographers from the courthouse grounds and typewriters from his courtroom. "There ain't going to be no more pictures snapping around here," he ordered. He also imposed a strict 3-day time limit on each trial, running them into the evening. He removed protection from the defense, convincing Governor Benjamin Meek Miller to keep the National Guard away. The defense moved for another change of venue, submitting affidavits in which hundreds of residents stated their intense dislike for the defendants to show there was overwhelming prejudice against them. The prosecution countered with testimony that some of the quotes in the affidavits were untrue and that six of the people quoted were dead. The defense countered that they had received numerous death threats, and the judge replied that he and the prosecution had received more from communists. The motion was denied. Commissioner Moody in Jackson County Circuit Court, CA1, went through every page of the Jackson County jury roll to show that it contained no names of African Americans. When after several hours of reading names, Commissioner Moody finally claimed several names to be of African Americans. Leibowitz got handwriting samples from all present. One man admitted that the handwriting appeared to be his. Leibowitz called in a handwriting expert who testified that names identified as African American had been added later to the list and signed by former jury commissioner Morgan. Judge Callahan did not rule that excluding people by race was constitutional, only that the defendant had not proven that African Americans had been deliberately excluded. By letting Leibowitz go on record on the issue, Judge Callahan provided grounds for the case to be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court for a second time. It was the basis for the court's finding in Norris v. Alabama that exclusion of African Americans grand jurors had occurred, violating the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. Haywood Patterson's Decatur retrial began on November 27, 1933. 36 potential jurors admitted having a fixed opinion in the case, which caused Leibowitz to move for a change of venue. Callahan denied the motion. Callahan excluded defense evidence that Horton had admitted at one point, exclaiming to Leibowitz, "Judge Horton can't help you now." He routinely sustained prosecution objections but overruled defense objections. Price testified again that a dozen armed Negro men had entered the gondola car. She said Patterson had fired a shot and ordered all whites but Gilly off the train. She then said the Negroes had ripped her clothes off and repeatedly raped her at knife point and pointed up Patterson as one of the rapists. She said they raped her and Bates afterwards, saying they would take them north or throw them in the river. She testified that she had fallen while getting out of the gondola car, passed out, came to be seated in a store at Paint Rock. Leibowitz questioned her until Judge Callahan stopped court for the day at 6:30. When he resumed the next morning, he pointed out many contradictions among her various versions of the rape. Judge Callahan repeatedly interrupted Leibowitz's cross-examination of Price, calling defense questions, arguing with the witness, immaterial, useless, a waste of time, and even illegal. The many contradictions notwithstanding, Price steadfastly stuck to her testimony that Patterson had raped her. Orville Gilley's testimony at Patterson's Decatur trial was a mild sensation. He denied being a bought witness, repeating his testimony about armed blacks ordering the white teenagers off the train. He confirmed Price's rape account, adding that he stopped the rape by convincing the Negro with a gun to make the rapist stop before they killed that woman. Leibowitz cross-examined him at length about contradictions between his account and Price's testimony, but he remained unruffled. Gilley testified to meeting Lester Carter and the woman that evening before the alleged rapes and getting them coffee and sandwiches. Callahan interrupted before Leibowitz could find out if Gilley went somewhere with the women that night. Prosecution called several white farmers who testified that they had seen the fight on the train and saw the girls affixin' to get out, but they saw the defendants drag them back. Lester Carter took the stand for the defense. He had testified in the first Decatur trial that Price and Bates had sex with him and Gilley. in the hobo jungle in Chattanooga prior to the alleged rapes, which could account for the semen found in the women. But Judge Callahan would not let him repeat that testimony at the trial, stating that any such testimony was immaterial. Ruby Bates was apparently too sick to travel. She had surgery in New York, and at one point Leibowitz requested that her deposition be taken as a dying declaration. While she was not dying, committed to his three-day time limit for the trial, Judge Callahan denied the request to arrange to take her deposition. The defense needed her testimony. By the time the deposition arrived, the case had gone to jury, and they did not hear it at all. David Patterson took the stand, admitting he had cussed at the white teenagers, but only because they cussed at him first. He denied seeing the white women before Paint Rock. On cross-examination, Knight confronted him with previous testimony from his Scottsboro trial that he had not touched the women, but that he had seen the other five defendants rape them. Leibowitz objected, stating that the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled previous testimony illegal. Judge Callahan allowed it, although he would not allow testimony by Patterson, stating that he had not seen the women before Paint Rock. Patterson explained contradictions in his testimony. "We was scared, and I don't know what I said. They told us if we didn't confess that they'd kill us, give us to the mob outside." Patterson claimed the threats had been made by guards and militiamen while the defendants were in the Jackson County Jail. He said threats were made even in the presence of the judge. Patterson pointed at H.G. Bailey, the prosecutor, in his Scottsboro trial, stating, "And Mr. Bailey over there, he said, send all the N-words to the electric chair. There's too many of them in the world anyway." Closing arguments were made November 29th through November 30th without stopping for Thanksgiving. Callahan limited each side to 2 hours of argument. Knight declared in his closing that the prosecution was not avenging what the defendants had done to Price. What was done to her cannot be undone. What you can do now is to make sure that it doesn't happen to some other woman. Leibowitz objected that the argument was an appeal to passion and prejudice and moved for a mistrial. Knight agreed that it was an appeal to passion. Callahan overruled the motion, Knight continued. "We all have a passion, all men in this courtroom, to protect the womanhood in Alabama." For his summation, solicitor Wade Wright reviewed the testimony and warned the jury that this crime could have happened to any woman, even though she was riding in a parlor car instead of the box car. Solicitor H.G. Bailey reminded the jury that the law presumed Patterson innocent, even if what Gillian Price had described was as sordid as ever a human tongue has uttered. Finally, he defended the woman. Instead of painting their faces, they were brave enough to go to Chattanooga to look for honest work. Bailey attacked the defense case. "They say this is a frame-up. They've been yelling frame-up ever since this case started. Who framed them? Did Ori Dobbins frame them? Did Brother Hill frame them? We did a lot of awful things over there in Scottsboro, didn't we? My, my, my. And now they come over here and try to convince you that that sort of thing happened in your neighborhood or your county." Judge Callahan charged the jury that Price and Bates could have been raped without force, just by withholding their consent. He instructed them, where the woman charged to have been raped is white, there is a strong presumption under the law that she will not and did not yield voluntarily to intercourse with the defendant, a Negro. He instructed the jury that if Patterson was so much as present for the purpose of aiding, encouraging, assisting, or abetting the rapes in any way, he was as guilty as the person who committed the rapes. He told them that they did not need to find corroboration of Price's testimony. If they believed her, that was enough to convict. Judge Callahan said he was giving them two forms, one for conviction and one for acquittal. But he supplied the jury with only a form to convict. He supplied them with an acquittal form only after the prosecution, fearing reversible error, urged him to do so. Of course, you are listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program and you want access to all of our bonus episodes, final chapters, advanced episodes, all commercial free, go to patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. or our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Darksider. And be sure to press the subscribe button as you're listening to us right now, whatever platform you're listening on. Tony and Sean with you on the final installment of the Scottsboro Boys story. And I don't think you could really, you know, this is like the textbook on a unfair trial. If you're like to learn like how to not do a court scene and how to not conduct a trial, this would be how to do that.
So here's the thing. We're going to, you know, put everything together and we're going to start the trial and this, that, or the other. Then, you know, maybe if it seems like not fair or racist per se, let's just add some African-American sounding names to the list. That'll even it out.
Yeah, I'm fixing to add some of them. That'll all work great down there.
Let's add, you know, a Johnson or a Le Johnson, perhaps a Le Sean.
And then it'll work. They'll all believe it.
There's so much information that is hypocritical.
Yeah.
There's one thing that makes a little bit of sense, and then not only hearsay, but something that actually took place that totally contradicts what was just done. And for whatever reason, whatever objections came about, it mattered not.
Yeah.
This is how we're going to do it. And I'm essentially going to zig and zag whenever I want to ultimately have the resolution and findings that I want, not that we find out.
I cannot imagine what life would have been like at that point in time, being a black person in America, living down there. Holy shit. I mean, just, oh my God.
And you factor it in current day, which you and I, as two Caucasian, middle-class, suburbia-living humans, I don't even know, you know, I'm not going to know what it's like
no.
to be a minority in the country in 2021. So I'm not going to act as though I would or could. But something that I would presume is very difficult in modern-day society, you add an even more narrow-minded, more ignorant, more any negative traits that you can pass along to people. I do not envy the position whatsoever. Not only do I not envy, I have so much hurt for people that had to go through this in their everyday life.
Yeah. It's just utterly disturbing. I mean, I'm trying to understand the women who were claiming rape. Didn't they also admit to lying about it too, like in a previous case? So,
correct.
So in one trial, they're like, "Nope, didn't happen," and then they're back going, "No, this shit happened." It's like, what the fuck? But they're separate trials.
We were scared, you know. We didn't want to get in trouble, so we just, you know, I don't know, he raped us. That's what happened.
So they admitted they made it up, and then in another trial saying it happened, all based on God. I mean, it's just, but that doesn't get brought into trial. That doesn't get brought up at all. Like, by the way, they already said they lied. They already said they lied about it. So what are we doing here?
Well, we're not going to let that come in, because then the whole court, the whole thing goes away.
Then everybody,
we gotta keep it on track here.
They all have to admit that they were wrong. And that's what it comes down to in so many of these things. When it comes down to people's fucked up convictions, like specifically like racist convictions, it's like, well, you know, it's like it was bred into you. It's like from a different time, different place. Yeah, I get, you know, when you're a child and you're brought up a certain way, I get where you would, at a young age, as a young adult, you're coming out of, you know, the oven, and that's where you're at. But you're now have free thinking and free will, and it's time to go, okay, some of these things were not right. And you don't have to just keep going down and repeating the path and the thinking of those before you to realize that that was wrong. But people are in such fear of ever admitting being wrong or that some way of thinking was wrong, especially when it's something that's so bred into you or your family thinks this way or that way. It's like, and it just comes down. I mean, it's fear, but it's also convenience because it's way too difficult to be the person in the racist family that's not racist. And if you do that, you essentially, you kind of walk away from that family because you really can't be a part of that on something that fundamental. At least my mind works that way. If I had a racist family, I wouldn't be part of that family anymore.
That's what we also talked about in prior episodes.
Yeah.
Whether the family's view is right or not, it takes a very strong willed individual to analyze, okay, is this just, this is how it's been forever and it's good, or this is just how it's been forever and it's bad, but this is just how it's been forever. And it takes a very strong willed individual to essentially move away, release themselves from the family and kind of go out on a limb, realizing this is screwed up, this is not right, and I'm okay, whether you want to talk to me or not, making my own, starting anew, this is how we're going to view this. And there are not a lot of people that want to go against their, well, this is just how it was and this is how I grew up. And particularly way back then, current day, you know, it's becoming more of, I don't want to say the norm, but a little less, oh my gosh, you would go against and not talk to any of your family members. I mean, I thought they loved you and you know, you had a very loving family. Well, I do, but they also have this extremely archaic view on insert topic, and I have no interest sharing that view. So, bye.
Yeah. I guess it's one of those things where it's an understanding of how one works or how others work. And that's something I think I struggle with sometimes, is trying to understand the minds of others and how they work. Because to me, it's just so cut and dry where I'm like, fuck that. If that's what my family was doing, I'm out. I don't care how much you loved me or this or that. That's lovely. But if you can hate a group of people for no reason, you know, with that sort of, you know, venom, I don't want your love. I don't know. I'm much quicker to write that sort of shit off and be like, okay, toodaloo. But I that's got to be difficult. I've never been in that situation, so I guess I can't speak to saying that this is how I would do it. But I'm pretty sure that's how I would do it if I were. Let's continue into the story here as the trial and the verdict continues. As time described it, 26 hours later came the resounding thump on the brown wooden jury room door. A bailiff let the jurors out from the Patterson trial. To the foreman unfisted a moist, crumpled note, handed it to the clerk. A thin smile faded from Patterson's lips as the clerk read his third death sentence. In May 1934, despite having run unopposed in the previous election for the position, James Horton was soundly defeated when he ran for re-election as circuit judge. The vote against him was especially heavy in Morgan County. In the same election, Thomas Knight was elected lieutenant governor of Alabama. Judge Callahan started jury selection for the trial of defendant Norris on November 30th, 1933, Thanksgiving afternoon. At this trial, Victoria Price testified that two of her alleged assailants had pistols and they threw off white teenagers, that she tried to jump off but was grabbed, thrown under the gravel in the gondola. One of them held her legs and one held a knife on her, and one raped both her and Ruby Bates. She claimed Norris raped her along with five others. Callahan would not allow Leibowitz to ask Price about any crime of moral turpitude, nor would he allow Leibowitz to ask why she went to Chattanooga, where she had spent the night there, or any about Carter or Gilly. Neither would he allow questions as to whether she had sexual intercourse with Carter or Gilly. During more cross-examination, Price looked at Knight so often Leibowitz accused her of looking for signals. Judge Callahan cautioned Leibowitz he would not permit such tactics in his courtroom. Dr. Bridges was a state witness, and Leibowitz cross-examined him at length. trying to get him to agree that a rape would have produced more injuries than he found. Callahan sustained a prosecutional objection, ruling the question is not based on the evidence. Ruby Bates had given a deposition from her hospital bed in New York, which arrived in time to be read to the jury in the Norris trial. Judge Callahan sustained prosecution objections to large portions of it. Most significantly, the part where she said that she and Price both had sex voluntarily in Chattanooga the night before the alleged rapes. Leibowitz read the rest of Bates' deposition, including her version of what happened on the train. She said that there were white teenagers riding in the gondola car with them, and some black teenagers came into the car. The fight broke out. Most of the white teenagers got off the train, and that the blacks disappeared until the posse stopped the train at Paint Rock. She testified that she, Price, and Gilly were arrested and that Price made the rape accusations, instructing her to go along with the story to stay out of jail. She reiterated that neither she nor Price had been raped. Leibowitz chose to keep Norris off the stand. Closing arguments were on December 4, 1933. In his closing arguments, Leibowitz called the prosecution's case a contemptible frame-up by two bums. He attempted to overcome local prejudice, saying, "If you have any reasonable doubt, hold out. Stand your ground. Sure, you're a man, a red-blooded he-man." The prosecution's closing argument was shorter and less barbed than it had been in the Patterson case. It was addressed more to the evidence and less to the regional prejudice of the jury. Leibowitz made many objections to Judge Callahan's charge to the jury. The New York Times described Leibowitz as pressing the judge almost as though he were a hostile witness. New York City Mayor Fiorella H. LaGuardia had dispatched two burly New York City police officers to protect Leibowitz. During the long jury deliberations, Judge Callahan also assigned two Morgan County deputies to guard him. The judge began deliberation on December 5th. After 14 hours of deliberation, the jury filed into the courtroom. They returned a guilty verdict and sentenced Norris to death. Norris took the news stoically. Leibowitz's prompt appeal stayed the execution date, so Patterson and Norris were both returned to death row in Kilby Prison. The other defendants waited at the Jefferson County Jail in Birmingham for the outcome of the appeals. Leibowitz was escorted to the train station under heavy guard and boarded the train back to New York. The case went to the United States Supreme Court for a second time as Norris v. Alabama. The court reversed the convictions for a second time on the basis that blacks had been excluded from the jury pool because of their race. Attorney Samuel Leibowitz, Walter H. Pollack, and Osmond Frankel argued the case from February 15th to the 18th, 1935. Leibowitz showed the justices that the names of African Americans had been added to the jury rolls. The justices examined the items closely with magnifying glasses. Thomas Knight maintained that the jury process was colorblind. Because the case of Haywood Patterson had been dismissed due to the technical failure to appeal it on time, it presented different issues. Attorneys Osmond Frankel and Walter Pollack argued those. On April 1, 1935, the United States Supreme Court sent the cases back a second time for retrials in Alabama. Waiting for the court, Chief Justice Charles Evan Hughes observed the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution clearly forbade the states from excluding citizens from juries due solely to their race. He noted that the court had inspected the jury rolls, chastising Judge Callahan and the Alabama Supreme Court for accepting assertions that black citizens had not been excluded. According to the U.S. Supreme Court, something more was needed. The court concluded the motion to quash should have been granted. The court ruled that it would be a great injustice to execute Patterson when Norris would receive a new trial, reasoning that Alabama should have opportunity to re-examine Patterson's case as well. Alabama Governor Bibb Graves instructed every solicitor and judge in the state, whether we like the decisions or not, we must put Negroes in jury boxes. Alabama is going to observe the supreme law of America. After the case was remanded on May 1, 1935, Victoria Price swore new rape complaints against the defendants as the sole complaining witness. An African-American, Creed Conyer, was selected as the first black person since Reconstruction to sit on an Alabama grand jury. The indictment could be made with two-thirds vote, and the grand jury voted to indict the defendants. Thomas Knight Jr., by now, May 1935, Lieutenant Governor, was appointed a special prosecutor to the case. Leibowitz recognized that he was viewed by Southerners as an outsider and allowed the local attorney, Charles Watts, to be the lead attorney. He assisted from the sidelines. Judge Callahan arraigned all the defendants except the two juveniles in Decatur. They all pleaded not guilty. Watts moved to have the case sent to the federal court as a civil rights case, which Callahan promptly denied. He set the retrials for January 20th, 1936. By January 23rd, 1936, Haywood Patterson was convicted of rape and sentenced to 75 years, the first time in Alabama that a black man had not been sentenced to death in the rape of a white woman. Patterson escaped from the prison in 1948. He published The Scottsboro Boys in 1950. That year, he was caught by the FBI in Michigan. The governor of the state refused to extradite Patterson to Alabama. He was later arrested for stabbing a man in a bar fight and convicted of manslaughter. Patterson died of cancer in prison in 1952 after serving 1 year of his second sentence. On January 24, 1936, Ozzie Powell was involved in injuring a deputy. During May 1937, Thomas Knight died. On July 15, 1937, Clarence Norris was convicted of rape and sexual assault and sentenced to death. Governor Bibb Graves of Alabama, in 1938, commuted his death sentence to life in prison. He was paroled in 1946 and moved north, where he married and had children. In 1970, he began seeking a pardon with the help of the NAACP and Alabama's attorney. In 1976, Governor George Wallace pardoned Norris, declaring him not guilty. Norris's autobiography, The Last of the Scottsboro Boys, was published in 1979. Norris died on January 23, 1989, of Alzheimer's disease. On July 22, 1937, Andrew Wright was convicted of rape and sentenced to 99 years. He was paroled but returned to prison after violating parole. Finally released in 1950, he was paroled in New York State. On July 24, 1937, Charlie Weems was convicted of rape and sentenced to 105 years in prison. He was paroled in 1943. On July 24, 1937, Ozzie Powell was taken into court, and the new prosecutor, Thomas Lawson, announced that the state was dropping rape charges against Powell, and he pled guilty to assaulting a deputy. He was sentenced to 20 years. The state dropped the rape charges as part of this plea bargain. Powell was released from prison in 1946. On July 24, 1937, the state of Alabama dropped all charges against Willie Robertson, Olin Montgomery, Eugene Williams, and Roy Wright. The four had spent over 6 years in prison on death row as adults, despite their ages. Thomas Lawson announced that all charges are being dropped against the remaining four defendants. He said that after careful consideration, every prosecutor was convinced that Robertson and Montgomery were not guilty. Wright and Williams, regardless of their guilt or innocence, were 12 and 13 at the time, and in view of the jail time they had already served, justice required that they also be released. After Alabama freed Roy Wright, the Scottsboro Defense Committee took him on a national lecture tour. He joined the United States Army. Later, he married and joined the Merchant Marine. After Wright came back from a lengthy time at sea in 1959, he thought his wife had been unfaithful. He shot and killed her before turning the gun on himself and committing suicide. On July 26, 1937, Haywood Patterson was sent from Atmore State Prison Farm. The remaining Scottsboro boys in custody, that of Norris, A. Wright, Weems, were at this time in Kilby Prison. And there is still a final chapter. There is more aftermath to this story that we'll get to in our final chapter. Thoughts on all of this and just really, you know, lives that were completely disrupted and disturbed. In some ways, you got to go and say, you know, I'm not surprised that some really dark paths were taken by some of these individuals, considering their treatment and the way that, you know, the life and our government and our society, you know, led them down for so many years and basically beat them down, broke them down. And then, you know, good luck trying to live a crime-free life, if you will, or a life that's not going to be chaotic.
Well, I think the only thing that could top the uniqueness of this whole travesty is if, upon going through this, folks got back to a normal life. with their three-bed, two-bath bungalow out in the suburbs and their white picket fence. I think it is par for it makes total sense that all lives were permanently screwed up.
Yeah.
And suicide and all the things that basically occur, whether you are on the doing bad side of the aisle or receiving poor treatment side of the aisle, this definitely affected you. This is trauma that the rest of your life will be permanently scarred from this event.
Yeah.
So as sad as it is, it's definitely not surprising.
No, it's not. It's sad. It's disturbing. It's let's put people through hell and then go, okay, good luck. Now you go out there and you go do your thing. Huh? You know, it's the same silliness that we have, you know, in places that we call correctional institutions. There's no correction going on in a lot of those institutions. It's just, let's put you here and make you even more, you know, pent up and violent. And then we're going to be surprised when you're back here again in a couple of months.
As much as we don't want to just kick the can down the road, this very easily could turn into a lot broader of a topic, but there's some things that one person can control and fix. And there's about 4.2 million things that it takes more than multiple people, just an entire change of protocol or change of laws.
Yeah.
And sadly, if you have so much vigor and you want to change something, that ultimately looking at it from an objective view and not subjective view, you can't. It will more than likely make you a little crazy.
Yeah.
Because you have so much conviction to want to better this, to see the absolute cluster that it is, you literally make yourself kooky trying to change it, opposed to taking all emotion out of it. And this is a situation that I would imagine, again, there's obviously the victims, which they're going to be screwed up. Well, because they had to go through it. But then on the flip side, if there's any good of this and any people wanting to make goodwill and to change, well, they, again, became a little bit cuckoo because this affected them as such.
Well, and you look at it, too. I mean, look at the years in these people's lives where they were being paraded around and accused of something they didn't do and had all that uncertainty. These are some of the most formative years of one's life when your brain is literally developing and growing and all that. And they did all this to them in those years. And then like, okay, you're an adult now. You're out. Now, good luck. It's like, yeah, you can't do that to somebody and expect everything to be A-okay. It's just, it's a sad all around. There's more to this. The final chapter, the aftermath of everything. We're going to jump into that. If you'd like to hear that, become a supporter of our program over at patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. Become a dark sider. Get access to all of our final chapters as well as advanced episodes of our show. And all of it is commercial free. So you can binge away on all of our episodes. No ads. It's all there. patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. Me and Sean will join you over there for the final chapter on the Scottsboro Boys.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take five before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.